Nathan, and welcome to Knoxville. Welcome back to Knoxville.
Thank you.
You were here last year, right?
I was here last year for the first time, and I'm thrilled to be back.
And we're thrilled to have you back. Since you were away, you managed to do quite a few things, one of which is write a new book. It's called Playing Changes, Jazz for the New Century. It's an incredible book. I recommend it to any jazz fan or any music fan that's interested in new music. It seemed to me like it was a book that was begging to be written, and no one had written it.
Thank you. That's a wonderful assessment. And it's how I felt about it. You know, it felt like there's all of this recent history and music and, you know, accomplishment that hadn't been served in book form, you know, and there was a certain amount of synthesis that I really wanted to do, drawing on all of the on-the-ground work that I had been doing as a critic and reporter. But the other thing is just so many jazz books take the measure of the 20th century, and there's almost like a bell curve shape where it sort of tapers off towards the end of the 20th century. And I felt like that's really doing a disservice to what I see as a really incredible period for jazz and improvised music. You know, there's so much happening. And so I wanted to kind of, you know, start towards the end of the 20th century and rev up from there.
It seems like the last 10, 15 years of jazz have been some of the richest, most creative, most interesting music that's come out of the genre ever.
I mean, that's a bold statement, but I wouldn't disagree with it. You know, I've been listening, you know, carefully, I guess I'd say, since I was, you know, in my, I don't know, maybe 10 years old. I'm 42 now. And I can say with confidence that I don't feel that the music has been in a healthier state during my lifetime. So I was born in 76. You know, I wouldn't argue with someone who glorifies the 50s and 60s. You know, like, I love classic jazz. I listen to as much Monk and Mingus and Miles Davis as anyone. But when I think about the culture of the music at the time that I began to read about it and listen to it, it was fixated on that. You know, it was fixated on what we had lost and this sort of bygone golden age that we were desperately trying to recapture or rekindle. And so it was very exciting to me as we began to move out of that reflexive motive and towards this idea of, like, well, what is it that we want to say? You know, what can we say to our time? And a generation or two of musicians have really seized that mandate and done fascinating and super compelling things with it. So, to my ear, to my mind, this is an incredibly exciting time.
I think I'm pretty much in the same boat. I mean, for example, Thelonious Monk is almost a mythical hero to me. I never tire of his music. I'll always listen to it, and even new versions of it. But I'm just as excited to find the new things that are coming out. And one of the records you talk about in your book is Brad Meldow's Largo record, which for me personally was like a real turning point where I was starting to lose interest in some of the things that were coming out. Not that they were bad or anything, but just like I was looking for something really different and fresh. And that record for me clicked in a really nice way. I still love the record. How did that make your cut?
Well, it was so, I think for all the reasons you just stated, you know, it sounds so distinctive and it doesn't sound like a fusion album, you know. It's very congruent with Brad's identity as a musician, you know, very sort of acoustically based and, you know, rooted in the jazz tradition, also deeply informed by classical music, but also interested in, you know, singer-songwriter stuff and classic rock. And so when he teamed up with John Bryan, the producer, they just kind of like geeked out on this kind of sonic playground. You know, how can we take what Brad does and make it sound different and give it a new inflection and a new color? So there's a real sense of play in Largo that I think comes across. And it's been, you know, as I noted in the book and I've noted elsewhere, it's kind of a sleeper album in a way. Like, it wasn't hailed as a landmark when it came out, really. But it's had this incredible influence on especially pianists, but not just pianists who followed. It's one of those albums that sort of stands alone in the way that it's affected the what came after.
Yeah, even the drum sound of the record, when I first put it on, I think When It Rains might be the opening track, and it's like, this doesn't sound like a jazz drum sound. I love the traditional jazz drum sound, but I was ready for something fresh.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that sort of liberation of the sound of the drums, even to like Mekhi McRaven or something like that, where they're taking all these great elements from the past but doing something really, really different with it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. And sometimes I encounter jazz listeners, jazz partisans who, you know, who get a little turned off by the marginalization of swing within some of this newer music. But when I hear Mekhi McRaven, and when you see him live, certainly, it may not be swing, but it's swinging. You know what I mean? There's a jazz feeling in what he does, you know, just as is a jazz feeling in anything that Brad Meldow does. You know, it's just there. Whether they're playing a straight eighth or something else, there's a real sort of sense of breath and connection to that tradition that just comes through.
The book is broken up into a lot of different chapters, and each one has a very unique sort of take or focus. One of the most interesting ones to me was the one called Learning Jazz, Chapter 7. Can you speak a little bit about how the more recent generations are learning jazz that was a little bit different?
Sure. It was important to me that there be a chapter on jazz education in this book. Most jazz critics don't pay a lot of attention to the jazz education, you know, the institutionalized jazz education. It's just a thing that happens in the background. But to me, it felt like if you're going to point to one factor that's been most influential in the evolution of the music in the last, you know, 40 years, I don't think anything touches at the rise of jazz education. I think it's been the most impactful and pervasive and sort of profound shift. And we can argue the merits, you know, we can argue whether that was for better or for worse. But I think, you know, it's inarguable that it was transformative to see jazz education go from this kind of niche pursuit to something that's so widespread. So I was interested in looking at how that happened, how it went from basically North Texas and Berkeley and, you know, a couple of very small programs to this huge booming superstructure. But I was also interested in the ways that jazz education and you know, its home in institutions sort of it filled a void when it came to mentorship, for instance. You know, we used to have Art Blakey. We used to have Betty Carter, these bandleader mentors who really formed a kind of informal but very serious institution. And this was the pipeline through which the most talented young jazz musicians, you know, that was when you were coming up as a teenager, that was your goal. It's like, I hope to play with Betty Carter, you know, because she's going to set me straight, you know. And it was a real sort of springboard. And when that began to go away, you know, we now have a system where if you're a really talented young musician and you go to an institution like the New England Conservatory or the New School or the Manhattan School of Music or, you know, Cal Arts, you will work closely with someone like that, you know, and they will be your ensemble teacher. They will be your, you know, your instrumental coach. And in many cases, they will also then, you know, become a real sort of like a real mentor, you know, and maybe even your band leader, you know, that we've got plenty of examples of that too. And so this has implications for, you know, a whole bunch of different things, you know, the proficiency and the literacy of musicians that come out of these music schools, but also the sort of social component. There's a lot going on there.
In Knoxville, we have, of course, the University of Tennessee, and there's a really healthy and long-running jazz program here, one of the first ones in the country. Jerry Coker started that one. But it's exactly what you're saying. So let's say that you're a music fan from Maryville, Tennessee, you know, a small little town near the Smoky Mountains, and you want to major, you play guitar, you want to major in something, you can come to this university, for example, and study with Mark Bowling, but also with Donald Brown, you know, who produced Kenny Garrett's last record, Gregory Tardy, who played with Bill Frisell on Wednesday at the pre-Big Ears thing. Again, maybe you're making connections and things that would never have existed. And I've seen it play out in the local music scene where you can tell the level of education and the mentorship is so effective because you go out and hear local jazz here and it's just incredible. And even like the alternative bands, you know, the drummer might be in the jazz program.
Right, right. You know, this is something that I wanted to sort of look at squarely too. There was a period when education became the norm, but the system hadn't quite figured out how to accommodate it. Because, you know, as an art form, jazz is not well served by traditional Eurocentric models of music education, right? It's not that kind of art form. It is more communal. It is more, you know, it's more of an oral tradition. It's more of a hands-on kind of experience. And so it took, I'd say, a generation or so before those models really worked, like to the best possible outcome, you know. And thankfully, we now have a situation where the best programs are just incredible, you know, because they're not only instilling skills and sort of literacy, but they're also really encouraging young musicians to figure out who they are as artists, like right out of the gate. And so that's one thing we've seen in this, you know, current moment, you know, like in this young century. We've seen so many young musicians who are basically coming out of the gate just bursting with ideas, you know, and they're not trying to conform to any received notion of what a jazz musician is supposed to be. They're coming out and saying, like, this is what I'm interested in, you know, and it may not fit anywhere on your spectrum, but this is like where I'm coming from and what I'm interested in. And so that's really exciting.
And these young people are going out and they're going all over the world. Jazz has always been one of the great American exports. And you hit on that in chapter 11 in The Crossroads. Did you actually go to the Blue Note in Beijing?
I did. Yeah, I was there for the grand opening. And it was very interesting because Beijing is in a transitional moment. You know, there's so much wealth in that city, but there's also the opposite of that. And it's an interesting thing to observe. The Blue Note Beijing is, you know, it's in what used to be the home of the very first U.S. ambassador to China. You know, it's right off of Tiananmen Square. And it's gorgeous. It's so, you know, I don't know how much, I think it's in the book, but I don't remember how much money was spent to renovate this place, but it was big money. I was there for the opening of this. Chick Corea played. There were all these local business leaders, and, you know, and it was this very kind of grand cultural event. But at the same time, I spent about 10 days in Beijing poking around and meeting musicians, and the jazz scene that exists there is happening much closer to ground level. There are all of these amazing little clubs in the hutongs. Musicians are just doing it for themselves, you know. It's in the level of musicianship. I did not expect, first of all, I did not expect it to be as high as it was, but I also didn't expect it to sound as contemporary as it did, you know. And this speaks to technology, right? The fact that even in China, if you know how to work around the various, you know, restrictions and firewalls, you can watch a live stream from Smalls in New York City, you know, and you can see YouTube videos of like you know, various festival concerts and club concerts, and you can see what's happening right now. And so the musicians I was encountering, you know, these Chinese musicians, if I'd closed my eyes, I could have been in Greenwich Village, you know? And so that was interesting to me. Now, the next step may be, having achieved that level of proficiency, maybe they will now begin to think about, okay, how do I incorporate a sense of place and reconnect it to being a musician in Beijing? I don't know. It's an evolving story. And I'm happy that I was able to get that into the book. But it, you know, 10 years from now, it's going to be quite a different situation there. And so I hope to return.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see where it goes from there, because, you know, Japan's always been like hugely supportive of jazz music. And I think China will be too. I think it might take a little while, but also very interested to see what comes out of there.
Well, can you imagine if there's a way to get jazz mainstreamed in China? Can you imagine what that'll do for the music? Just in terms of, you know, consumer base, you know? I mean, Japan is a model for that. You know, the Japanese jazz public is incredible. And the level of their enthusiasm and the level of their erudition. And if you manage to do something similar in China, I mean, it would be so huge. I mean, it's an uphill battle, but it's one worth thinking about.
Well, they need a Yao Ming, the basketball player,
right.
Someone to like just
right.
sort of break through. Speaking of breaking through, who do you see are the great emerging female jazz artists and creators?
There are so many, and in many different sort of stylistic corners. Well, the very first artist mentioned in the book is Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, right? And she's just an amazing artist to me, because she thinks so much. She's so thoughtful about her relationship to the tradition and her art form as this kind of almost an act of criticism, you know? She's interrogating things. So Cecile is certainly someone to watch.
The gentleman is a dope, a man of many faults, a clumsy Joe who would know a rumba from a waltz. The gentleman is a dope and not my cup of tea. Why do I get in a dither?
In the more sort of swinging traditional vein, you know, you have someone like Bria Skomberg, Anat Cohen, you know, and then on the more avant-garde side of the spectrum, obviously I love Mary Halverson. She often works with Ingrid Laubrock, the saxophonist. There's an amazing pianist named Chris Davis. You know, we could just go on and on and on. And I think it's encouraging that it's no longer, or it should no longer be seen as unusual or exotic in some way to see a woman really killing it on the bandstand. You know, whether it's Linda Oh on bass in her own band or in someone else's band, you know, whoever it is, you know, Elena Pinderhughes on flute. Last night I saw the Artifacts Trio with Tamika Reed and Nicole Mitchell. You don't point to these as like really good female jazz musicians, you know what I mean, or really good female improvisers. Nicole Mitchell is at the very top of her game and her place. You know, there's not another flutist in jazz who's doing what she does. And I would say the same for Tamika as a cellist. And so that's really heartening to me, you know, that we have come to a place where I feel like there's a lot of progress that has been made. Now we need to just keep it going, keep it moving forward.
One of the interesting things about last night, and we recorded this during the Big Ears Festival, is I went out and saw, I don't know, four or five acts last night, and I didn't even realize almost all of them were women. And that for me felt like progress, because I didn't even notice it. I was just like, well, of course.
Right.
And Rachel Grimes, the Artifacts Trio, as you mentioned, and the ballet. Hey, there's hope. At the end of your book, you do something very brave. You list 129 essential recordings, and a lot of people are always afraid. I'm afraid when people say, you know, what's the best thing that's come out lately? I always almost get paralyzed because, like, I don't want to make the wrong choice or leave out something that I really love. But you just put it on the line. You put 129 essential recordings there, some amazing things. I'm not going to tell people what's there. You got to get the book to find out. But any standouts in 2019 so far?
Ooh. There's a fantastic alto saxophonist originally from Chicago named Greg Ward, and he has an album out this year called Stomping Off from Greenwood. Just a killer album. I would say that the new release from Christian Scott Atunde Adjoa, Ancestral Recall, is also worth looking at. There's a new ECM release by Vijay Iyer and Craig Taborn playing duo piano, and that's something that is featured at Big Ears in 2019 as well. I've seen them do it in concert before. That's fascinating. I kind of feel like that's ideally a concert experience rather than an album experience, but that's you know, those are two of my favorite musicians. So yeah, there's plenty of stuff coming out. I was very excited to see that Maria Schneider is going back into the studio this fall to work on her next album. So, you know, it never stops. There's so much great stuff that continues to come out. You know, you mentioned that appendix. It was a challenge for me because I set certain ground rules, and one of them was that I was not allowed to repeat an artist. And so then I find myself in the situation, okay, well, if I'm going to just choose one Brad Meldow album or, you know, one Joshua Redman album, what's it going to be? Where does, you know, where in the trajectory am I planting that flag, you know? So that was a fun little puzzle to work out. That appendix was included sort of at my editor's prompt. You know, he said, I think we need to have a list, you know, like a list of albums. And I kind of dragged my feet. I said, I don't know. Like, but I found that people really, really respond to that. You know, in some cases, it's the first thing they respond to. They're like, oh, thank you. Like, this is a roadmap, you know? And so I've come to really embrace it, this idea of, you know what, you can argue with it. You know, you may have a different set of must-hear albums, but I guarantee, like, everything on here is great. You know, it's every album on that list is going to say something to you. And they're all albums that I treasure. So it's fun. It's a fun way to engage with this, you know, this really unruly kind of, there's so much happening. Here's one direction I can point you in.
Yeah, I just want to, like, hand it over to some of the jazz students that come into the station and say, like, you know, go here. And there's enough there to keep anybody busy for quite a while. And that's the exciting thing about jazz is I don't know what's coming in next week.
Right.
I know somewhere, somehow, something's going to blow me away probably within 3 weeks. Just it's just guaranteed past this prologue. It's an exciting time, and I'm very excited, Nate Chenin, that you took the time to come down to WUOT and talk with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, thanks to our guest, Nate Chenin. His new book, Playing Changes, Jazz for the New Century, is available just about everywhere people can find good books. It looks like we're about out of time on improvisations. I'm going to go home and release the hound. The hound did not care for the Big Ears Festival. The hound says, hey, I've got big ears. Where's my attention? So I'm going to go take care of that. Have a great evening, everybody.